Hey y'all, welcome to episode 6 of the Plaid Pilot Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Weld. 112 years ago this week, Blanche Scott became the first woman in the U.S. to solo an airplane, so today we're talking about 5 pioneering aviatrixes you should know. Joining me to tell their unique stories is former avionics tech and current Northrop Grumman test conductor, Casey Truman. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Tired. Just set up in a ground station for 7 to 8 hours.
So you were supporting the Artemis launch this morning that didn't happen, right?
Yes, we got confirmation that we couldn't support it, sadly. They had a lot of problems they were trying to fix. And we're like, they're not going to be able to fix this in time. But we were ready.
Ready for it. Is there a new scheduled launch date, or is it just on hold for now?
They have a backup, and it's Friday.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool. So hopefully that'll happen on Friday. And lightning. It was lightning and then the frost that did it, right?
Yes.
No, it was that the launch is physically... Because where are you out of?
I'm out at Edwards right now.
Okay. And then that's where it was actually taking place?
Mm-mm. It was taking place in Florida.
Oh, okay. Nice. So it was remote support that you were providing for it then?
Yes. We had a specific place that we had to be at, and we're supposed to take some telemetry for them. We were there. We were ready because, you know, Global Hawk can sit for a while in an area.
Oh, so it was the Global Hawk was actually supporting the launch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I work on, I don't know if I told you this, but I work on some of the oldest Global Hawks in existence still.
Okay. And those are the ones that NASA owns, or?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't you tell everybody a little introduction and who you are and what you do and that kind of thing?
Hi, I'm Casey Truman, and I am a test conductor for Northrop Grumman.
Cool. So what tests do you conduct? Are you allowed to talk about that?
A test conductor is like a catch-all be-all. So like I am a big part of the test portion of this project. Between our payloads and whatnot, we're testing more for that. And I also am one of the few people who maintain the ground control station.
Okay. So like basically where the operator sits,
mm-hmm.
when yes. the aircraft is in the air.
Yes.
Cool. So you were actually involved in 2014 in a milestone flight for the military with the RQ-4, right?
Mm-hmm.
Called the Flight of the Lady Hawk.
Yes, I wasn't a part of the launch, but I was a part of the recovery.
Oh, okay, I couldn't remember. I mean, I was stationed there at the time. I think I helped move some age around or something like that. So I know they had to move shifts and stuff like that. But it was the longest unrefueled flight for the Air Force, correct?
Yes. I don't remember the exact hours, but we're somewhere between 34 to 36 hours of straight flying.
I was thinking at the time it was 34.2, I think was the record
that they set. Yes. So yeah, I think we're above the 34.
Have they beat that yet, or is that still record, or do you know for sure?
As far as I know, that still stands, but these civilian aircraft aren't exactly the same as military abuse, I guess.
Right. A little bit different there.
Yes.
So, and that was an all-woman flight crew.
Yes.
All-woman flight crew and mostly woman maintenance crew, but they're because of the, you know, lack of women in the squadron, I think there had to be a little bit of supplementing on the maintenance side of the house. But
oh, yeah, because I think at the time there's just 3 of us.
Because this was the beginning of 2014. Mm-hmm. What was it, like March or May, maybe?
I think it was March, yeah.
Okay, that sounds right. Sometime in the first half, because I was there when it occurred, and I had June of that year I was deployed, so I know it was the first.
That was the year of my first deployment, too.
Yeah, you went, I guess you went other side of the globe, but right after I mm-hmm. left, I think. Well, that kind of ties into the theme of today. So the kind of the theme of today's show is women pilots. This week, we don't actually know the exact date. I'll talk about that in a minute. Blanche Scott actually became the first woman in the United States to solo an airplane. So kind of in honor of that, we're going to be talking about 5 women pilots, aviatrixes, that you probably haven't heard of that you probably should hear of.
Before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to take a moment to recognize the Plaid Pilot Podcast Aviator of the Week. Charles recently soloed at DeLand Municipal Airport in Florida. Now, this wasn't his first solo. Charles had previously began flight training and ended up putting it on hold. Now, almost 20 years later, he's back in the saddle, proving it's never too late to start or to start again.
Hey, Charles. So how are you doing today?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad.
I hear an accent. Are you from Australia?
No, I'm from England.
England? Okay.
Came over here, what, 2005? Something like that.
Okay. So what got you into aviation?
So I've always been into aviation, through my dad. I mean, as a kid, you know, we get the Chuck gliders. We buy the old red 27 meg radio control gliders from the local model shop, take them up to the park, crash them, smash them, and so. I've always been fascinated with planes and aviation in general. Being from England, obviously, there's a lot of World War II museums and stuff like that. And it's just been one of those things I've always been around. My dad, he was Spitfire nut all the way. And, I am to some degree, but came down here, started researching flight schools, here being Florida. Started going to school, flight school here, late 2005. Did that, got 30 some odd hours, did my 172 solo, and one thing and another, the flight school I was with ended up screwing me out of my money, and I'm like, that's it, I'm done, I can't do this.
So didn't end up getting your pilot certificate at that point.
I basically got like I say, it was like 27 hours. I'd soloed. All I'd pretty much got to do, was just basically the cross countries, the night flying, and that stuff. But at that point, I just lost motivation. Didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah, it took the wind out of your sails.
Yeah, pretty much. Fast forward to 4 years ago, just before COVID, my dad got diagnosed with motor neuron disease, and he lost all use of the left side of his body, his left arm, his left leg. My mom's got cancer. She's been in for surgery. They have carers there all the time now. Me and my partner and my son went over, go visit them, because, I didn't know how long my dad was going to have, or my mother for that matter, because it was pretty bad.
Right.
And I sat there talking, and we're like, what? We haven't done for a while. Let's go over to RAF Cosford. Obviously, my son's never been. So we go over there, and of course, that kind of sparked everything. I was talking to my dad, and one thing led to another. It's like, one thing I miss is I wish I could go flying again.
So was your dad a pilot?
No, he wasn't. He never got that chance.
Okay.
He got the chance to fly a Spitfire. There's a Spitfire. It's what they call the Grace Spitfire. It's based at RAF Duxford, which is still an RAF base, but it's also got a big museum and everything else. And it's a two-seat trainer. So for my dad's, either his 40th or 50th birthday, something like that, we paid, my mom, I should say, paid the £10,000, or like $15,000, for him to go and spend an hour fly a Spitfire. That was That was his thing.
That's quite the birthday present.
Yeah, he came back like a kid in a candy store.
Oh, I bet.
So glad he did that. But we were talking. He's like, I wish I could go flying again. And that kind of subconsciously triggered it, I guess. Last year, my dad died. I really want to do this for my dad. And so when I came back, and that's when I found out about light sport. So I was worried about the medical. And with light sport, as long as you haven't been denied a medical, you don't need one. You can just self-certify, so to speak. So now it was just a case of trying to find somewhere that did it. And I found Aerosport in DeLand. The instructor I had at the time, Engels, who's an Air Force pilot, and we went up, and I loved it. He came down and he asked me, he's like, "Well, how do you feel?" I'm like, "Let me paraphrase. I've bloody missed it." For those of you that haven't flown, you won't understand it until you go up and fly it.
Yeah, you get that Discovery flight, and they're usually not too bad, $25 or $50.
But it was something like that, maybe $50, $60 now with the price of gas and the way things are.
Right.
But yeah, it wasn't exorbitant at all.
So when you got around to doing the solo, how was that? Did everything went smoothly, or was it a little bit of a bumpy ride? How did that go?
The ironic thing was, I went up with the, because you have to do, you know, a certain amount of landings before you solo, so to speak, with the instructor, just to make sure, you know, get it in your head. This is what we're doing. This is what you've got to do. Make sure you got it in your head. You know, so we did that, and it's like, look, I need to go pee. I'm like, I'll taxi it back. Oh well, I landed, pulled off the runway. He took controls. He taxied it halfway back to the hangar. And he comes around and says, like, "I'm dumpy. See you later. Bye," and walked off. And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "What are you still sitting there for? Go!" And then it registered what he was talking about. So, you know, startup checklist. It's all on the YouTube video, curses and all. So I did the startup to run up and everything else, and I'm getting set to go. And you'll see it in the video. I've got the checklist in my hand, the before takeoff checklist in my hand. You can see it at the bottom of the frame. The very first line of that, flaps 17. The flaps are the big handle on the top right-hand corner of the video. I forget to pull the flaps down.
Okay. So took off without flaps.
I took off without flaps. Now, luckily, we're on a 3,500-foot runway. That thing takes off in 400 feet. And you'll hear when if you watch it, when I lined up ready for the next one, that's the first thing I do when I'm putting that down while I remember.
How are your landings? I know I've talked to some people who they say on their solo, their landings improved greatly, and I've personally, on my solo, the landings were not so great.
They were better than they normally were.
Oh, okay, good.
And I think a lot of that was I'm more relaxed because I've not got somebody sitting next to me.
And I've heard that before.
I wouldn't say they were butter landings. I didn't grease them, but I didn't break anything either.
That's what matters.
I taxied back. I got out. I literally just burst into tears.
Was that emotional of an experience for you?
I got some of my dad's ashes in my pocket.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that's what I'm referencing. If you listen, come on, Dad, this is the last one we got to do. I've got my hand on my leg. It was like, yeah, it was emotional. It was relieving.
It's almost like a closure moment too.
A little bit, yeah, because it was something my dad never got the chance to do by himself.
Right. Well, it's you got it knocked out now, and congratulations. It's a big deal. Even though it wasn't technically your first solo in 20 years, I think still counts for something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you had all of that. It meant even more than it would have the first time, given, you know, your dad's story and all of that. So that's really cool. I appreciate you coming on and talking to me about the experience. If people want to follow along, because obviously you're still working towards that certificate, and you said you wanted to get your glider and that kind of thing. People want to see what you're doing on Instagram. You have see what you're doing on any social media. You have anything you'd like to share on that?
Yeah, flying.cab, CAB being my initials. I couldn't think of anything fancy.
That'll do it though, and I'll link to that in the show notes so people can come find you and see what you're doing over there.
And then my YouTube channel, which mainly has a lot of radio control flying stuff on it, is Daytona FPV, Foxtrot Papa Victor. There is a playlist on there that I'm starting. I'm not really done any lessons because the Sting is not GoPro friendly as much as the Bushcat is, as far as mounting places. And I was just at the point where I just wanted to get it done. I didn't want to worry about video or anything like that. I just needed to get myself going. But my two pre-solo videos are up. My solo video is up. There's going to be more on there as I go through. Now I've got that out of the way and the hard work begins.
Yeah. It's always a learning experience. So I'll definitely link to that YouTube channel as well. People can see if they want to see some RC flying stuff. And then of course your solo video. Thanks again for coming on.
No, I appreciate it.
So Blanche Scott, she was born April 8th. We can agree on that. She was born sometime between 1884 and 1889. Depending on where you look, you can find a couple different years in that span. She was born in Rochester, New York. So she has a lot of parallels with Harriet Quimby. So if you listen to episode 2, I talk a lot about Harriet Quimby. And she was born around the same time. Both her and Quimby, they took an early liking to cars. They could both drive at a fairly young age. Blanche Scott, her father actually purchased a car when they lived in Rochester, New York. She learned how to drive at an early age. By 14 or 15, she had been driving for a while. Of course, this is before, you know, you had to be a certain age to drive. Mm-hmm. If you had a vehicle at your disposal, you basically, in most places, could just drive it. But around that 14 or 15 year mark, her parents started getting a little concerned that she liked things like cars and was becoming too much of a tomboy. So they sent her off to a finishing school to, I guess, turn her into a proper lady.
Oh man. Sounds rough.
Right. I don't know what all that entailed. But I can't imagine that for a young woman who loves driving cars and that kind of thing, that she would have enjoyed it too much. At some point she, you know, finished her finishing school. And then in 1910, she became the second woman to drive across the country. She went from New York City to San Francisco. So kept that love of cars, acquired one, and drove it from New York City to San Francisco. You can find in some places that she was the first woman to do that trip, and that's not accurate. Almost, but not quite. The year before, Alice Ramsey actually made the same trip.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, I didn't realize AAA was actually around. They were formed, I believe, in 1903.
Really?
And yeah, I had no idea that they'd been around that long. And they were actually producing road maps. And there wasn't very many paved roads at the time, but AAA had some road maps, and they would find the telephone poles that had the most wires, and they would just follow them, assuming though that's going to lead to the biggest town.
Clearly, she was right.
She made it, so she must have been. But I can't even imagine just not knowing where you're at.
Yeah,
yeah. The trip for Blanche took over 2 months. So she finally rolled into San Francisco behind schedule by a considerable amount, 23rd of July in 1910. And she got national attention for this because she's only the second woman to do it. This time, most women don't drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a friend, a woman friend that was on the trip with her. So she wasn't completely alone, but she didn't know how to drive. So it was all Blanche doing the driving.
Mm-hmm.
And so she becomes this, you know, I don't want to say national hero, but she definitely has a lot of national attention. And Glenn Curtis, who was an aviator at the time, had his own flight school. He actually agreed to personally teach her how to fly. And that doesn't seem that significant, but he actually had a no women policy at his flight school.
Really?
Yeah. And it wasn't uncommon at the time either. The Wright brothers, they, at their school, they had a refusal to teach any women to fly. Their sister, I think, actually, the Wright brothers' sister, she wanted to learn how to fly, and they wouldn't even teach their own sister.
Wow. So,
yeah. But Glenn Curtis decided that he would break this rule because, you know, how famous she became with this cross-country drive,
mm-hmm.
and figured, I guess, that it would probably gain some notoriety for the school as well.
Was it? As long as it's good publicity, right?
Right. So he had a flying school, this Glenn Curtis, his flying school was in Hammondsport, New York. And the way that they learned to fly back then, for the longest time, you just taxied around the airfield and they would put a limiter on the throttle. So you could only throttle up so high. And it was supposed to be high enough or low enough that you couldn't get off the ground, you know, give you enough so that you could learn how the airplane handles on the ground, but you wouldn't have to actually worry about going airborne. And we don't know exactly what happened. We don't know if the limiter malfunctioned, if she, I mean, she's liked cars for years. Mm-hmm. We can assume that she was probably somewhat mechanically minded. Maybe she tampered with it intentionally. We don't know the exact story, but sometime between the 2nd of September and the 6th of September, while she's taxiing around on the airfield, either something happens to the limiter or she catches a really big gust of wind, she actually gets airborne and flies up to an altitude of 40 feet and then makes a smooth landing, which is great because at 40 feet, if she had not had a great landing, it could have ended poorly for her. But luckily, somebody on the airfield actually witnessed that because, you know, she was doing, I think it was a maintenance technician that witnessed it. About a week and a half or 2 weeks later, a woman named Bessica Raish, it was on 16 September. Bessica Raish actually soloed an airplane. And so for a little bit at the time, she was credited as the first woman to solo an airplane. But luckily, like I said, somebody on the airfield saw what Blanche had done and had to, you know, write a formal statement or whatever saying that he witnessed this happen. So she did get credit for being the first woman. And for some reason, we don't have the exact date, which you think we would since, you know, somebody had to basically testify. But I wasn't able to find that document. So yeah, she ended up getting credit for the solo. She went on to fly for the Curtis Exhibition Team. She was the first woman stunt pilot. So that stunt piloting back then was just an absolutely insane gig because, you know, very dangerous.
Sounds like it. I was going to say, but it sounds super dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, even now we have accidents, but back then it was something else. But they got paid very well. A lot of the people of her time, especially that were doing the air shows and the stunt pilots, had these accidents and died as a result of those. She didn't. She lived a long life. She worked as a radio personality, a screenwriter, and an actress. She was actually in the very first film about flying, according to the National Women's Hall of Fame. It's the first movie or first film about flying, but it was called The Aviator's Bride, and she starred in that. So you can actually look Blanche Scott up on IMDb, and she's in there.
Really?
Yeah. When I Googled her name and I saw her pop up on IMDb, I thought, well, that's weird. It must be a different one. And sure enough, it was her. She actually went to work for the Glenn L. Martin Company, which eventually, through a whole bunch of mergers and that kind of thing, ended up becoming the Lockheed Martin that we know today. But she was the first American woman test pilot working for that company. And then, like I said, we don't know exactly what day she soloed, but the 6th is often cited, and I wonder, we do know that on the 6th of September of 1948, she became the first woman to fly on a jet airplane with Chuck Yeager at the controls. And I'm sure you've heard a lot about Chuck Yeager working out at Edwards Air Force Base.
Yes.
He's kind of an aviation hero in general, but especially out there. She also served as a consultant for the United States Air Force Museum, and she's responsible for, I think I read it was somewhere around $1 million worth of early aviation memorabilia that she was able to go around and, you know, use her connections and procure for this museum. So it's kind of a neat legacy. If you ever go there, you know, she helps with a lot of the earlier artifacts there. She did pass away in 1970, which would have put her probably in her 80s, depending on what year, which for a test pilot back then, just to think of the things that she saw.
Yes.
From even 1889, airplanes aren't a thing. We have people that are gliding. And then she saw, you know, we landed on the moon before she passed away. So it's just an insane amount of development that she would have seen in the aviation community, in the world in general, I guess. And they, so to celebrate her life in 1980, the USPS, they actually issued an airmail stamp. A handful of the people we've talked about on this podcast have gotten airmail stamps from the USPS, which is kind of cool. I guess they recognize aviation with airmail stamps. I don't even know if you can buy airmail stamps anymore. Do you know?
apparently they became obsolete in 1975.
Yeah, 1980 they issued one, so I wonder if it was more of just like a memorabilia.
Yeah, I think that's what that means.
Just kind of a souvenir type thing.
Yeah.
A way for the post office to recognize or honor somebody with. Okay, cool. But yeah, and then in 2005, the National Women's Hall of Fame, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. So yeah, that is Blanche Scott in a nutshell. It would be cool to do an episode at some point, a little more in-depth.
Oh, yeah, about her life. I mean, the stuff she saw was pretty crazy.
All right, so number two is Bessie Coleman.
Yes, I've been reading up on her, and she has lived a crazy life for as short as it was. But she died doing what she loved, so.
Yeah, and that seems to be a theme for most of the aviators and aviatrices we talk about.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. But she is considered the first African and Native American woman to hold a pilot's license. She went to Europe to get it. Was with the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale June 15th, 1921. Got her pilot's license.
So she had to go there, right? She couldn't find a school that would.
Nope, they didn't want to teach her. And that was her dream, was once she got that, she realized that she wanted to develop her own flight school so she can teach other African-Americans how to fly.
Not make them have to go to
All the way across
Europe.
Across the pond, as they say.
Yeah.
She had a couple nicknames throughout her her short time. One was Queen Bess and or Brave Bess. Her final flight was surprisingly in Florida, April 30th, 1926, in Jacksonville. Yeah, she got thrown first, and because she was flying with the guy who was ferrying the plane to her that they just bought, it threw her out, and she died on impact. Then he died on impact in a flaming ball. Apparently, it was due to, sadly, maintenance. They torqued the wrong part, and it made the gears inoperable.
So what year was she born in?
She was born in January 26, 1892.
Okay. So right within 10 years of Blanche Scott, she was born. Mm-hmm. And you said 26 is when she had her final flight?
Yep. She was ahead of her time.
Yeah, for sure. Because she was doing the barnstorming stuff, right?
Yes.
So basically air shows would tour around with all these other pilots, or was she solo, or was she part of a exhibition team?
She was solo, but she did do the school, did go with them, if that makes sense.
So she wasn't necessarily a part of their group, but she performed at the same events that they performed at.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense. I wasn't sure if obviously there was a lot of racist sentiment at that time, if there was an exhibition team that would bring her on, or if she had to basically strike out on her own.
She kind of struck out on her own, but she did do the stunt flyers and stuff. It was pretty cool reading about her until she had to go to Europe. She had to sail to Europe to go there, so that was a whole long trip.
And at that point, couldn't hop on a plane and get across. at least not very commonly. I know Lindbergh was in 27, but that was the first solo. Okay, so the first transatlantic flight looks like it was actually in 1919.
Wow.
So technically, she could have flown across had she known somebody that would have taken her.
Yes.
But it was certainly not a common thing back then for transatlantic flight. And she actually went to Europe twice, right? To get her initial
training.
Just, right.
Yep.
And then went back for the kind of aerobatic stunt flying.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine she's been inducted into multiple halls of fame or stuff like that. Were you able to find any of that information?
Yes. She's been inducted into a bunch of hall of fames, and she's got a couple of places named after her. They have the International Space Hall of and Air and Space Hall of Fame in San Diego. She's got a place in Tampa Airport that is named after her. I believe it's a road. It's the same thing for the O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. There's also a public library named after her because of all that she had done, especially with her in her position. She was a really big activist for her community, especially dealing with all the racists at the time and the racist mentality. Oh, so many people came out for her her funeral, and it just showed you how much of an impact she had on her community itself. It was like, I believe 10,000 people showed up, which, yeah, it was a lot. I was very surprised to read that.
Yeah. For the time, I imagine that would have had to have been one of the larger funerals at the time.
Mm-hmm. She was, I believe, inducted in 2006 into the National Aviation Hall of Fame, and then 2001 for the Women's Hall of Fame. And she's placed at like number 14 on the list of like 51 heroes in aviation.
Okay.
But yeah, it's she lived as much as she lived a short life, she had such an impact across the board in between aviation and in her own community. It's impressive to read.
Mm-hmm. The United States, they're issuing, they have a series of quarters that are going to feature women from history.
I remember that, yes. And I believe she got her own quarter too. Was it 2023?
Yeah, I think it's set for release next year, but she's already been slotted for, I don't know if they've already struck the coins and they're just waiting to release them, mm-hmm. or how that works, but she's definitely been selected for that position, so that's pretty cool. I mean, how many people today in the States, if there was a thing that they wanted to do and you said, yeah, sure you can, but you're going to have to fund your way and sail a ship for probably between the two places less than a week. But still, you know, you're going to have to get on a boat and go across the ocean to a place that, you know, and she had to teach herself French, I think, didn't she?
Yes, she had to teach herself French, which I'm pretty sure took probably a hot minute.
Oh, I imagine. Yeah. And just think of all the people, you know, you have a dream to do something and say, yeah, you can absolutely do that, but you're going to have to teach yourself a new language, get on a boat, go halfway across the world and learn this thing. A lot of people, just the price for entry would, you know, knock them out of the game right there. And mm-hmm. that she stuck with that, I think says a lot about her.
Sometimes there's a dream worth fighting for. And she fought for hers.
Mm-hmm. There's actually a kid's book. I think about it when I see it, and I always forget. I want to get it for my nieces. It's called Fly High, The Story of Bessie Coleman, and you can get it on Amazon. It's a kid's book, but kind of tells her story. So
that's really cool. Like, I like when they do that. They tell people's story and how they impact different aspects or the time period. Because I think a lot of times most people typically kind of shy away from this history.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And this one in particular, you know, when you look at some of the women like Amelia Earhart and Blanche Scott, they did things that were unconventional and society certainly didn't want them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when you add in that element of race at the time, it's a whole nother level of, you know, they were able to find somebody in their community roughly to teach them to fly,
mm-hmm.
where she had to go halfway across the world.
Yes. Yeah. They had people that were like, I like your spunk, kid. I'm going to teach you. And they're like, everyone to her was like, nope, I can't do that.
But she didn't let that stop her, which is incredible.
Nope, she didn't.
All right. So number three is Hazel Ying Lee. Hazel Ying Lee was born in Portland, Oregon, August 24th of 1912. She actually grew up with seven siblings. She was athletic, enjoyed sports as a kid. At a young age, she started working as an elevator operator in at a store. She was a Chinese American. Her parents actually had come to the United States from China. And at the time, unfortunately for Chinese immigrants, elevator operators, at least around Portland, that was about the only job that they could get unless they owned their own mm-hmm. business, which her parents did. But so she starts work as an elevator operator. At 19, she took her first flight, and that's where she caught the flying bug, got hooked on flying. And you can find different accounts of that. Some people say that she was at an air show, and her and a friend went up in an airplane at this air show. Some accounts say that this friend was taking flying lessons and offered to let Hazel go along with her. And you can find both of those accounts. But at the age of 19, she goes flying with a friend and gets hooked on flying. And within a year of that first flight, she was became one of the first Chinese American women to earn a pilot mm-hmm. license. This was in October of 1932. I don't know. Everywhere I see says she was one of the first. I can't find a name of anybody who held a pilot license, a Chinese American, who had their pilot license before she did.
Oh, okay. I see.
Chinese American woman, anyway. So I can't find the name of anybody that had one before she did, but I can't say definitively that she was mm-hmm. the first. But she was definitely one of the first. This was in October of 1932. So she actually learned how to fly from Al Greenwood. And it's funny about this Al Greenwood. Every place that I read about him, it says that he's like a famous aviator, a renowned aviator. And the only thing I can find on him is that he taught Hazel how to fly. So I don't know if his claim to fame is that he taught her how to fly or if he had done other things, which if so, great.
Yeah. You
know, but they talk about him like he's a very well-known aviator. And I had never heard of him, but I don't know everybody. But then when I started looking him up, everything came back to he taught Hazel how to fly. That's his claim to fame, I guess. In 1933, she went to... So this is about the time Japan is... World War II hasn't started yet, but Japan is starting to get aggressive in the Pacific, and they've actually invaded Manchuria.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so, you know, of course, she has a lot of cultural ties to China. So she, in 1933, she goes to China. You know, she's already been a pilot for a short time now, and she actually wants to fly for the Chinese Air Force against Japan and help fight off the invasion. So she goes across the world the other direction, and they told her no. So they did not, the Chinese Air Force would not let women fly. So she picked up an admin role, still wanted to help out and do what she could. And then she also served as a commercial pilot in China. She found a private airline that would allow her to fly commercially for them in China while she did this admin work for the Chinese Air Force.
That's crazy. You can get commercially done, but you can't. Military won't want you.
Right. I would think in that situation, things are pretty dire. Mm-hmm. You know, Empire of Japan is knocking at your doorstep. You would think you'd want all hands on deck, but I guess they weren't hurting that bad at the time.
Not yet, at least.
Stuck to those guns. Right. And in 1938, the Japanese actually began bombing Canton, which is where she was living in China at the time. And so she stayed there for a little bit, tried to help some friends get free, get out of that situation, ended up going to Hong Kong, stayed there for a while, and then eventually moves back to New York City. She realizes she's got to, you know, come back to the States. In New York City, she gets a role, an admin role again, buying war materials to help, you know, in that effort. And she did that for a while, but she's really wants to fly. In 1943, the WASP is formed. I should have that written down what that acronym is, but I don't.
It's the Women's Air Force Service Pilots.
Okay. Women's Air Force Service Pilots. And so basically that was this core of, women pilots, and they were allowed to fly with the Air Force, basically moving planes around and that kind of thing. Doing the more civilian type flying in the States, weren't allowed to fly combat missions, but still got in the air. So she was contributing by flying. The WASP, actually, there were over 1,100 pilots during World War II that served in that organization. And only two of those were Chinese.
Wow.
So she was one of only two Chinese American pilots that were allowed to fly. And I don't know if there was an application process. I'm sure there was, but she was accepted as one of only two Chinese American pilots for the WASPs.
Cause I think it was the, as much as the WASP are doing the ferry missions with, the aircraft to specific locations, they were also doing, the testing for these aircraft so that they could get them out faster because more people realized that they were more I wouldn't say more competent, but they were competent enough to fly these things and be actual, like, great test subjects to make sure that they're ready for the war and all of that. So that's a big portion of what the WASP did as well. Like,
I didn't realize that.
134 total WASP were qualified to pilot high-powered engine, single-engine fighters.
Okay. Nice. So she was part of that elite group within the WASPs. That's cool. She actually had, during her career, she had two incidents where with flying. One of them, she had to force a landing into a Kansas farmer's field. So I don't know if she had engine trouble or what it was, but she had to put down in Kansas, lands in this farmer's field, and he sees this woman of Asian descent, and he assumes that she is a Japanese pilot, and so he actually goes after her with a Pitchfork.
Oh, wow.
So she was finally able to make him realize that she was not a Japanese soldier, and she wasn't seriously harmed in that incident. So that was the first incident that she had. The second one, she was actually ferrying a P-63 into Great Falls, Montana. And while she had already been cleared to land, and then there was another flight of P-63s that was incoming, and ATC kind of had a panic moment.
Oh, no.
And yeah, and they did not handle it correctly. You know, whatever the case was, they weren't able to divert that flight of P-63s away. And one of them actually collided with Hazel's airplane and ended up on the ground in a big fireball. And this was actually on Thanksgiving Day of 1944.
Oh, man.
November 23rd. Yeah. So she was pulled from the burning wreckage. Mm-hmm. Her, you know, flight jacket and everything was still smoldering. And she was alive, but she was severely burned. And then 2 days later, she actually succumbed to those injuries. And so she died on November 25th of 1944. Wow. As a result of that plane crash. Yep. And there were 38 WASP pilots that died during the war, and she was the last one.
Do you know that the WASP are considered civilians, so they didn't receive any military benefits?
I did, many, many years too late. In 1977, all WASPs were granted military status. So they finally retroactively went back and said, okay, everybody who flew with the WASPs is now officially granted military status.
Well, that's good.
It's too late, but yeah, it was definitely, it was good that they finally recognized all of the, you know, everything that they did, the sacrifices that they made. And, you know, they, as test pilots, even in, you know, her case as a ferry pilot, it wasn't without danger. Mm-hmm. And they were still, they weren't in combat, but they were still putting their lives on the line to help get the airplanes out. Mm-hmm. To the combat zones. She actually in 2004 was inducted into the Oregon's Aviation Hall of Fame. And then in 2010, she, along with all of the other pilots that flew with the WASPs, they were granted the Congressional Gold Medal.
Oh, wow.
Number four is Jackie Cochran.
When you talk about the WASP, she was one of the head honchos on that. Do you know that she actually initially started writing to, I believe it was Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady, to try and get the WASP instated.
Okay, so she was basically lobbying.
Yes, lobbying
first lady at the time.
Yep, lobbying the chance to start the WASP service with the armed forces. She had to convince so many people to let them do this. Jacqueline Cochran wasn't actually her name, her given name when she was born. It was apparently Bessie Lee Pittman.
Really?
Born in Pensacola.
Wow. So do you know why she changed her name? Because that's not even, you know, with Blanche Scott, she often went by Bessie.
Yeah.
But you can turn Blanche into Bessie fairly easily.
But not a Bessie into Jacqueline.
Right. Do you know the story behind that, or what's going on there?
There's not a lot of information on that when I was looking that up. It just said that she had changed, started going by Jacqueline instead of Bessie. And then she married a guy named Robert Cochran. And then she kept his last name and just started going by Jacqueline Cochran. And
strange.
I'm assuming she just liked it better.
I think because she was actually in the military, or was she she was obviously part of the WASP, but she was had a military association before then, right? Or not?
I don't think she was. She did eventually join the Women's Army Corps. WAC. I do know that. So she eventually became military, but she petitioned the First Lady at the time, and then she petitioned Lieutenant Colonel Robert Olds, who was the guy that was organizing the Air Corps Ferrying Command. So they were the aircraft delivery service.
Okay. And so she basically wrote to him and said, hey, we have all these women who know how to fly airplanes. Mm-hmm. We can help you out and get more of the men that you will let fly combat missions get overseas and start flying those missions, and we can handle the home front, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Prior to that, she was still big into the aviation at the time. She was known as the speed queen. And by the time of her death, no other pilot held more speed / distance or altitude records in aviation history than her.
I love that, because it's not that she, for a lot of these things, the women weren't allowed to participate. Mm-hmm. So your first everything was a man, and so you have a lot of these first woman to do this, first woman to do that. But she held more records than anybody, man or woman, mm-hmm. in the aviation space. I think that's really cool. And when was it that she died? It was fairly recently, wasn't it? Within the last 30 years?
Yeah, it was in the 80s. She died August 9th, 1980. I mean...
Okay, it was longer ago than I thought, but yeah.
It's definitely still like 10, 13 years prior to me being born, but she did a lot in her lifetime.
Yeah.
She did. Was a part of the 99s. She wasn't a founding member, but she was definitely one of their most influential members to date.
And she was president for a time, right?
Yes, from 1941 to 1943. And she was also friends with guess who, which I believe was a founding member of the group, Amelia Earhart.
Okay. Yeah, if actually you go listen to episode one, my guest on that episode, she is actually a chair of the Kentucky Bluegrass chapter of the 99s. And we actually talk about Amelia Earhart in that episode, but she talks a little bit about what that organization is. So definitely go check that out if you haven't.
It says in this article that I was reading that this is where she pulled a lot of the women from for the WASP was from this group.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay, nice. I didn't realize that. That's cool. Yeah, it's a cool organization. They do a lot of scholarships for women. And
you know, she was the first woman to fly a bomber. The Lockheed Hudson 5 across the Atlantic.
I did not know that.
No. Yeah.
Really? Okay. Do you know what year that was in?
June 17th through the 19th in 1941.
Okay. First woman to fly a bomber, and she flew it across the Atlantic. Yep.
Twin engine.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's super cool.
They actually named the airport that she, her home airport, they named it after her, didn't they?
I believe they did, yes.
And that's out in California.
Because mm-hmm. she...
Your neck of the woods.
Yeah. Yes. Everybody knows where Coachella is these days, right? She actually was living in the Coachella Valley, and that's where she died peacefully at her house. She was a part of a test in up here at Edwards as well. She was the first woman to break the sound barrier.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yep. Did
she do any work with Chuck Yeager?
Yes, she did. They're good friends.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yep. And she was
cool. So a lot of Edwards history.
Yes. She lived a long life and did great many things.
All right. Number five on the list is Willa Brown. So Willa Brown has a huge list of firsts. She was born January 22nd, 1906 in Glasgow, I think that's how you pronounce it, Glasgow, Kentucky. At some point, her parents moved the family to Indiana because Kentucky was still segregated. And this is back in the early 1900s. And Indiana had already integrated their schools. And so her family decided that she would have a better education in Indiana than she would in Kentucky. So they moved the family. She graduated high school in Terre Haute. And then she went on to the Indiana State Teachers College, mm-hmm. which is now Indiana State University. And she graduated with a bachelor's there in 1927. So she taught high school for a little while in Gary, Indiana, mm-hmm. from 27 until 1932. And, you know, the Depression is taking hold at this point. And so not making great money while she's teaching. So she's picking up a couple odd jobs, did some social work and stuff. And that she got a job with the WPA, which was the Works Projects Administration, mm-hmm. as one of FDR's groups or whatever that he formed during the Depression to try and bring people out of the Depression. Mm-hmm. So she moved to Chicago with that organization doing social work. And while she's there, she meets John C. Robinson. And he ends up taking her to get her introduced to aviation. And she starts taking lessons at Harlem Field, which is, at the time, the airport was still segregated. So Harlem Field was for the African Americans to fly out of. And she learned from this John C. Robinson and Cornelius Coffrey. So both Robinson and Coffrey, though, were huge on trying to integrate aviation, flight schools and that kind of thing. And so she was learning at Harlem Field with these two individuals, but she also was able to take some classes at the Curtis Wright Aeronautical University, which had recently integrated. Something interesting, the reason that they recently integrated is because these two gentlemen threatened to sue the school if they didn't. So they were basically, at the time, they said, we will not take African-American students. And these two gentlemen, they had money, and they said, we will take you to court, and we will sue you if you don't integrate. So they decided they didn't want to fight that battle, and they integrated. And so she was actually able to take classes at the Curtis Wright Aeronautical University.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. So she, very well educated. She went on in 1938, or no, I'm sorry, 1937. She actually earned her MBA. And then she went on to marry Cornelius Coffrey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this time between 1935 and 1939, she gets her master mechanic certificate and pilot license. And then she goes on to get her commercial pilot license. So she became the only woman to hold both the mechanic certificate and the pilot certificate, and to be an African-American woman at the same time.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So her and Coffrey are married, and they decided they want to start this flight school. And because even though, you know, the Aeronautical University was forced to integrate, mm-hmm. they wanted to build this school that African-American pilots could come to and there wouldn't be any discrimination. So they formed this flight school. They also, Willa Brown was one of the founding members of the National Airmen's Association of America, which was the first Black aviators mm-hmm. group. And so her and Coffrey, they have, you know, this foundation or this association, they have their flight school. Willa is doing all kinds of lobbying work to get the U.S. Army Air Corps. She's trying to get them to integrate. And they actually got their school approved for the civilian pilot training mm-hmm. program, which was basically the military knew they couldn't train all the pilots that they needed. So they would pick these flight schools around the country, and the civilian flight schools would train the people, and then they could pick people from their school to go fly for the war and learn how to fly for the military, but already having that flight background, basic, you know, maneuvering and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so their school got approved for that. And what's cool about that is that Willa and her husband actually trained over 200 future Tuskegee Airmen. So with this program, you know, they had sharp students and they would recommend them up to the military. And then over 200 of those students went on to become Tuskegee Airmen. So that's, she had a huge part in that. She wasn't actually in the military, but she did join the Civil Air Patrol, mm-hmm. Which is kind of like the civilian auxiliary to the Air Force.
I remember hearing something about them. They're still relevant today. I remember that.
They are. Yeah, they do. Now they do a lot of search and rescue stuff and some anti-drug flights, flying over looking for marijuana fields and stuff like that in the mountains. But yeah, so Willa was actually the first Black woman to be an officer in Civil Air Patrol. So she holds that as a first as well. She was the first African-American woman to earn her pilot license and commercial pilot license in the States.
Really?
Yeah. So she was really a trailblazer. After the war, her and her husband get divorced. They close the flight school down. She kept lobbying, you know, always fighting for equal rights and integration and that kind of thing. And she actually ran for Congress. So she was the first African-American woman to run for Congress.
I saw that. And I was like, out of Illinois, right?
I think so, yeah. And she lost the race, mm-hmm. but the fact that she ran, you know, at all was really said something mm-hmm. about her at that time, because that was the late 40s. She passed away in 1992, and she's actually buried in the same cemetery as Bessie Coleman. We talked about earlier.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Lincoln Cemetery in Illinois. Both Willa Brown and Bessie Coleman are buried. So if you're ever in the area, stop in and pay respects to two aviatrixes.
That'd be cool.
In 2002, Women in Aviation International, it's an organization for women aviators, mm-hmm. they named her top 100 influential women in aviation. And then in 2003, she was inducted into the Kentucky Aviation Hall of Fame. So she was born there, obviously moved away at a fairly young age, but they still consider her one of their own. So definitely good to see some aviatrixes on this list that lived out nice long careers and did a lot of great things mm-hmm. and were able to die at a nice old age, yep. or a decent age at any rate. Cool. Well, I did actually get a message from somebody on Instagram. At the end of last episode, I asked everybody if they could pick one person from you know, history or even today mm-hmm. to fly with, who it would be. And he actually sent me a DM on Instagram. Yeah, here he says, "Hey, I've been really busy lately, but I just want to say that the last two podcasts have been awesome. Really enjoyed both of them. If I could fly with one person, that would be a tough decision to make. It would either be Josh Flowers from Aviation 101, Jason Shepard from M0A, or Chris Palmer from Angle of Attack. That was David from Texas.
Okay.
Sending a message on Instagram. Really cool to hear from people. And of those three, I think I'd definitely love to take a flight with Jason Shepard, get some of that. I don't know if you've watched the M0A videos. It does a lot of flight training stuff.
A little bit, not a whole lot.
Yeah, he actually has a flight school in Florida.
Oh.
But yeah, I would love to get a couple hours of instruction with that guy. So thanks for writing in, David. And definitely if anybody else has wants to get in touch, certainly do that. You can always shoot me an email at todd@theplaidpilot.com or on Instagram at @theplaidpilot. Well, hey, thank you so much for doing this whole thing. I know with your schedule and everything, you're probably falling asleep, but I really do appreciate you coming out and talking about some of these awesome women.
Yeah, no, I had fun. Thanks for having me. It was I didn't know you had started a podcast, and this is so cool. So I was glad to be here, glad to support.
Well, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show and learned something new. If you have, make sure you never miss an episode by following on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you've been listening for a few weeks now, please consider rating or leaving a review. It'd really mean a lot to me to see that. Y'all stay safe this week, and as my wife always says, fluffy landings.